From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. NPR listeners know Neil Conan as the host of Talk of the Nation, as well as a longtime reporter and anchor. But for the summer of 2000, Conan left NPR to be the play-by-play radio announcer for the minor league baseball team, the Aberdeen Arsenal. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about the minor leagues and Conan's season with the Arsenal, and we'll hear some of his play-by-play. He's written a new book called Play-by-Play, Baseball, Radio, and Life in the Last Chance League. Also, rock historian Ed Ward remembers Martha and the Vandellas. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Secretary of State Colin Powell said today that the Mideast peace process must go on, despite the latest suicide bombing in Israel. Powell said the Bush administration will keep pressing for an end to the violence. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon cut short his visit to the United States and returned home, blaming the leadership of the Palestinian Authority for the attack that left 15 Israelis dead. Sharon suggested that Israel might respond with more military action. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat condemned the attack and called for an end to attacks on Israeli civilians. By a vote of 306 to 117, the House has decided to go ahead with plans to store nuclear waste in Nevada's Yucca Mountain. The vote overrides Nevada Governor Kenny Guinn's veto. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
Advocates of using Yucca Mountain as a nuclear waste repository argued there's no other realistic alternative to storing 77,000 tons of radioactive waste that might otherwise be used by terrorists. Virginia Republican Rick Boucher.
The waste is now stored at 72 dispersed reactor sites around the nation. Leaving the waste in its current storage poses threats both to the environment and to national security.
Massachusetts Democrat Ed Markey said Yucca Mountain is not the answer.
This facility, which is being contemplated, will only hold 60% of all of the nuclear waste in the United States, military or civilian. Doesn't solve the problem.
But lawmakers from states with nuclear reactors favor using Yucca Mountain, and the Senate is also expected to override the Nevada governor's veto. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
Boston's Cardinal Bernard Law completed a day of questioning under oath. His deposition was in connection with more than 80 civil lawsuits alleging Law was negligent in supervising a pedophile priest. Monica Brady Meyerhoff reports from member station WBUR.
In his deposition, Cardinal Law said he relied on subordinates to take care of complaints about sexually abusive priests. Law said he didn't recall reading a letter from a parishioner warning about defrocked priest John Gagan's behavior, even though he acknowledged his handwriting was on the envelope, calling the matter, quote, urgent, and asking someone else to follow through. The cardinal told lawyers he was aware Gagan had a history of homosexual involvement with young boys, but he relied on the advice of doctors before assigning him to a new parish. But Law said he had no system in place to make sure the right medical experts were involved. Both doctors consulted by the archdiocese had no expertise in sex abuse cases. For NPR News, I'm Monica Brady Meyerhoff in Boston.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 305 points, or 3%. It closed at 10,141 in very heavy trading. The Nasdaq gained 122 points to close at 1,696. This is NPR News. The FBI says a 21-year-old college student has admitted planting pipe bombs in mailboxes in five states. The FBI filed court papers saying that Luke Helder admitted to planting 18 of the bombs. The devices hurt six people in Illinois and Iowa. In Pakistan, at least 11 French citizens and two Pakistanis were killed today in a suicide bombing in the port city of Karachi. Dozens were injured, some critically. NPR's Michael Sullivan reports.
The bombing occurred shortly after 8 o'clock this morning outside the Sheraton Hotel. The explosion left a large crater in the pavement that destroyed several vehicles, including the bus carrying the French workers and the car believed to belong to the bomber. Officials say the workers were part of a team working on a submarine bought from France for the Pakistani Navy. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack, but suspicion has already fallen on Pakistan's militant Islamic groups, many of which are angry at Pakistan's president, General Pervez Musharraf, for his decision to side with the U.S. in its war against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Pakistani officials today described the attack as an act of terrorism aimed at foreigners. At least six foreigners have been killed this year in attacks blamed on Islamic extremists. Michael Sullivan, NPR News, New Delhi.
The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has given more than 100 energy producers just 2 weeks to submit information about their electricity trading deals during the California power crisis. The commission requires a top-ranking corporate officer to submit a sworn oath saying the company did not engage in tactics similar to those of Enron Corporation, which is accused of manipulating the market. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at www.fordfound.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. NPR listeners are used to reporter and host Neil Conan sounding something like this.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow during this hour, we'll look at some of the reasons why people go to college.
But for one summer, Neil Conan left NPR so that he could do this.
There's a fly ball down the left field line. Lofton is running. I think he'll have room for this one. No, he will not. That's a solo home run. And the Arsenal have gone back to back.
During the summer of 2000, Neil Conan did play-by-play radio announcing for the Aberdeen Arsenal, a minor league baseball team in the Atlantic League. It was the team's first and only season. The Arsenal was co-founded by Cal Ripken Jr. and his family as a memorial to Cal Ripken Sr., who was a coach and manager in the Baltimore Orioles system. Aberdeen, Maryland was Ripken's hometown. Neil Conan has written a new book about his baseball summer called Play-by-Play, Baseball, Radio, and Life in the Last Chance League. Conan is the host of NPR's Talk of the Nation. He's also reported from the Gulf War, covered defense issues, and has anchored live coverage of presidential elections, inaugurations, speeches, and the impeachment hearings. Let's start with a reading from his book, Play-by-Play.
I was no longer 50. I was going on 51. My daughter and her boyfriend drove a Ryder truck up from college to move her stuff to Florida. I have a wonderful job as a radio news correspondent and host that's allowed me to go to all kinds of places and do interesting things, but I was bored, probably with myself. Call it burnout or midlife crisis, but after Whitewater, Newt, Monica, and impeachment, I was weary. With bleak months of what promised to be a joyless presidential election campaign stretching ahead, I thought it miraculous when Keith Lupton called with a chance to broadcast baseball instead. This was fate. I cashed in 23 years of tenure at National Public Radio and abandoned wife, children, yard, cat, and a career inside the Washington Beltway to punch my ticket to the small time. This summer, my audience would be measured in dozens, not millions. Accustomed to broadcasting with the help of two technicians, a producer, and a director in a state-of-the-art studio, I would be a one-man traveling band. I called up the team's schedule on my computer. In late July, I could anchor three nights of the Republican National Convention live from the First Union Center in Philadelphia or call play-by-play of a three-game set against the Bluefish at Harbor Yard in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Baseball sounded like a lot more fun.
Oh, Neil Conan, sure, baseball sounded like more fun, but still, why did you go through with it? It's still a big risk.
It was a big risk, but that was really the reason to do it, I think, at the time. I'd sort of gotten into a rut. I was just tired and a little bit frustrated with myself, and I needed to break out. I needed to do something. There's those moments in your life where you feel, you know, something's got to happen or I'm going to explode, and something happened, and I had to take it.
No, you're right. It was good to escape to a place where we all know the rules of the game. What was comforting about that?
It was comforting. Well, one of the things about baseball is that you're the same age and you're all ages. When you walk into the ballpark, you're 8 years old and you're 14 years old and you're 23 and you're 52. Another thing about baseball that's really gratifying is, as you mentioned, the rules are the same. You know what's going on. And baseball is one of those things that truly rewards study. The more you know about it, the more interesting it gets. And that was really one of the great revelations of the summer. There was a fear that, you know, after a while you'd get bored with this too. And that didn't happen at all. And one of the things that was really critical about that whole summer, and This was the idea of, I kept talking to ballplayers about why they did it, why they took the chance to play in this Verschlugener league and at the end of the road. And a lot of, and they had many different reasons, but I one of the most compelling was the idea that they had to go out there and compete, that it was hard to do this. This was difficult to do. And I realized that one of the things that was happening to me at work and early in the season doing the play-by-play stuff was I was intimidated by something that was so difficult to do. It was very, very hard. And if I looked at that instead as a challenge, as an opportunity, the way the ball players did, you know, I really want to go up against that. He's the best pitcher in the league. If it were me, I'd be looking for a way to, you know, come down with a sore throat that day. but instead, you know, they were really looking forward to this challenge. And you know, as a ball player, as a hitter, if you succeed one time in three, you're doing great. So two times out of three, you're going to fail. And at those ratios, if they could take the rejection that involved, I sure could too. And my rejection rate wasn't anywhere near as difficult or as impossible as that. It was hard to do it. And I really began to appreciate how difficult it was and how much enjoyment I got from the fact that once you started the game, you finished the pregame show and they threw the first pitch, you just stepped off the cliff. Nobody knew what was going to happen.
Well, in your book, Play by Play, you say that this is the golden age of minor league baseball. What are the signs of that?
The signs of the golden age of minor league baseball are the quality of the ballparks that these teams are playing in, the amount of attendance that they get from the people who live in the immediate area, and the excitement that they generate. And I think to some degree it's a bit of rejection of some of the, you know, the expense and the difficulties and the arrogance that you see at the major league ballparks a lot. The game has bucolic roots, sort of. But the fact of the matter is that we all want to feel as if we have a connection with the ballplayers. And if somebody's making, you know, $120 million over the next 10 years, it's a little difficult for most of us to wrap our minds around that and to see this guy as, you know, us. But if somebody's out there playing for $800 a month, well, that's pretty easy. He is us. That's something, that's a place we've all been.
You know, but you say although minor league baseball is in its golden age and you really like it a lot, the stadium isn't really quieter and purer in terms of noise. What's it like in the minor league stadiums?
It is even busier and noisier, if you can imagine that, than it is in the major league parks. There's something going on all the time. Between innings, the public address announcer has a routine. Every ballpark has this kind of idea of a personalized public address announcer who comes on, and they play games with the kids, the dizzy bat race where people spin around and then they try to run a straight line and fall over, and that's always a winner. Or, you know, two six-year-olds do the base race with the team's mascot who always loses. And those sorts of entertainments go on between innings on the theory that this is family entertainment, and they have to find a way to keep the kids busy and entertained. There's always music coming out of the speakers, especially when the home team is batting. And all of these almost carnival-like appearances between innings, it's not at all your image of baseball in the quiet countryside where there's time to contemplate. No, there's da-da-da-da-da at every possible moment. And they try to keep the game entertaining as a product. And again, a lot of the teams in minor league baseball, to improve their appeal to families, and that's the core of their appeal, have put in things like carousels for kids to ride on. They'll have somebody come out and do face painting. They'll have jungle gyms, a play area for the kids to crawl around in, special concession stands where for $1 a kid can go get a hot dog and a Coke and something like that. It's all geared to family entertainment, and it's really worked.
Well, actually, your first night of broadcasting, you almost didn't make it on the air because you couldn't get the system to work.
Yeah, that was loads of fun. I was the one, the general manager, Keith Lupton, said, well, what kind of equipment should we buy? And, you know, I came up with all of these, suggestions, and some of my colleagues here at National Public Radio, in fact, gave me some advice. And so we bought all of this equipment. It's thousands of dollars of stuff with microphones and mixers and a box that connects my telephone line to the the line back at the to another box back at the station, and it's supposed to transform a regular old telephone line magically into a decent quality broadcast circuit for very little money. That's kind of the whole idea of minor league baseball. But we couldn't get it to work. We couldn't get the marriage of the two machines to last more than 20 seconds. And I'm sitting there sweating bullets as we're trying to get this to work for the 100th time. The public address announcer is announcing, the bank president and the general managers on the field, and Vi Ripken, Cal Ripken Sr.'s wife, is about to throw out the first ball of the season to Bill Ripken, the team's director of operations, who's behind home plate. This is an important event. This is, the moment that really they had a radio deal for was to publicize this opening event. And what you're hearing on the radio station is a Coast Guard public service announcement playing over and over again because we can't get on the radio.
What happened?
Finally, the chief engineer at the radio station figured out a way. They didn't have a phone coupler. That's the normal way to just get a phone call on the air. We could have done it without the... But they didn't have a phone coupler at this radio station. It was so small. So the chief engineer figured out that the only way to get on the air was to have me just make a regular phone call from the press box to the studio, put that phone call up on the speakerphone, put a microphone on the speaker from the speakerphone, and that was what was on the radio. And I just had this feeling that Guglielmo Marconi was rolling in his grave. This was probably the worst audio that had ever been broadcast on FM.
It was probably pretty unlistenable. You're probably on the air in name only.
And just as well, because I was screwing up the broadcast, in all of the confusion, I finally got in the air. It was the top of the first inning, and I, announced the first batter, and he struck out. Hey, there's the first out of the season and all this sort of stuff, and the next batter hits a single into center field, and that's when I notice that there's a runner rounding third. Where did he come from?
You were actually afraid you'd be fired. At least that's what you say you were
I was terribly afraid I was being fired.
What were some of the things that were going wrong in the early broadcasts?
Well, I didn't know any stories about, this was a brand new team, and these guys all had baseball histories, but I didn't know them. And, they don't have baseball cards. There's no media guide that gives you, 15 pages on Danny Perez and what he does and what pitches he likes to hit. And all this, I didn't have anything to talk about early in the game. And there were these long, awkward gaps. And it became progressively more difficult as you say, well, then I've got to say something important. I've got to say something clever, something good. And then, you freeze. And the other problem I would have was actually describing the action. And I would try to be doing too much at the time. The ball is rolling out to the gap in left center field, and you're trying to describe the runner rounding third and about to come home, and then the left fielder chasing the ball. And I would start to get confused, and it was difficult to string together a narrative of what was actually happening until I remembered. This is one of those lessons that I learned working at National Public Radio and substituting for Bob Edwards on Morning Edition and talking with Red Barber all those years ago. And Red said there was only one thing that a play-by-play announcer really had to do, and that was follow the ball and explain what was happening with the ball. And you can back and fill later to explain what was happening with the people on the bases. And once I remembered that, it became a little bit easier. And finally, there was this 14-inning game we had out on Long Island. I was desperate for short games, just because a short game's 2 hours and 15 minutes, something like that. A slugfest can last 3.5 hours. This is a 14-inning game, and finally, it was part of it that the Arsenal finally won the game late in the 14th inning. But extra inning ball games are by their nature close, and close games are by their nature interesting. And by the end of that game, I really thought I had it whipped. I thought it'd been a pretty good story, and that maybe it wasn't terribly, terribly embarrassing.
Well, why don't we give a listen to you in the announcer's booth doing play-by-play at a very manic moment.
There's one belted into right center field. Nobody's going to catch this one. That's gone! Back to back to back! The Arsenal, for the first time in club history, have three consecutive home runs. Cepeda, Martinez, and now David Steed. And they lead the game 8-3.
Neil, how do you decide, how excited to get? Because there is a certain amount of theater in all of this.
Oh, sure. A lot of it's performance.
Yeah.
You tend to get more excited about your team's home runs than the other team's home runs, for sure. And that was a terrific moment for the ball club and against a particularly hated rival, the Nashua Pride, who drubbed us in their ballpark, it seemed, every single time, and came back eventually and made that one a nail-biter before it was over. One of the things that a lot of people ask me about, you know, is did I have a home run call? And, well, you just heard one. And I tried not to develop, the, you know, that sort of cookie-cutter, one-size-fits-all home run call. You know, the see ya, or there it goes, Papa, or one of those, you know, the trademark home run call. Because, you know, each one, it seemed, deserved its own description. But you find out baseball is a game where a lot of things repeat themselves. Situations repeat themselves and kinds of hits repeat themselves. And there are certain kinds of home runs. And, yeah, you do develop certain patterns and degrees of excitement. But you're trying to bring the audience along with you. And that was a tremendous moment. Frank Zappa, the famous rock musician and composer, once said, loud and soft, that's showmanship. And it's true in play-by-play, I suspect, just as much as it is in music.
Now, in listening to a little bit of your play-by-play, I noticed there wasn't a lot of fan noise behind you, some of the play-by-play. Is that because of the way you were mic'd or because of the lack of fans?
That was because it was an Arsenal home run in the visiting ballpark. There were, in fact, a fair number of fans that day in Nashua, but they wouldn't be cheering the opposition's home run. And it was sort of odd that I had to pick out when I was pulling tape clips to find any crowd sound at all. I had to get all the stuff on the road. There wasn't any sound at all from the crowd at Arsenal games because there wasn't much of a crowd at Arsenal games. There was one doubleheader that we had started the second game. There'd been rain problems, and we started the second game at 10 o'clock at night, rather late, during a weeknight, just about anywhere to start a sporting event. And we counted 12 people in the stands, and all of them were in some way related to somebody either working at the ballpark or on one of the teams.
Wow. My guest is Neil Conan, host of NPR's Talk of the Nation and author of the new book, Play by Play. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Neil Conan, host of NPR's Talk of the Nation. His new book, Play by Play, is about the summer of 2000 when he worked as the play-by-play radio announcer for the minor league baseball team, the Aberdeen Arsenal. When you're in your capacity as reporter or host for NPR, you have to be, a fair and objective and distanced and all of that. When you're announcing baseball, you're supposed to be really engaged and enthusiastic when your team wins and really manic when there's a home run. Can you talk a little bit about the different voices that you've used on NPR as a reporter or host compared to the voice of Neil Conan, baseball play-by-play announcer?
In my job as host of Talk of the Nation, it's clearly my job to be objective, to not take sides. When you're announcing for a baseball team, for the local team, you work for the team and you are expected to take sides. And that's not to say that you're going to, you know, dump on the opposition and say that everything they do is terrible. That's not, you have to appreciate the opposition. In fact, one of the things you need to do if your team's going to be any good at all, if your champions are great ball players, well, they have to be playing against great champions. It's not Ali without Frazier, if you understand what I'm meaning. So the other team have to be respectable. But yes, we're on our side. And after a lifetime of being on the sidelines as an observer of all of this, it was so refreshing and so nice to actually be able to take sides and feel good about it. It was the right thing to do. It was our team.
And how did play-by-play change your voice?
Oh, that was interesting, too. Noah Adams, our colleague, had always talked about finding your note as a broadcaster, the spot in your chest and your throat where your voice sounds nice and comfortable, and you get that resonance that we're all looking for, whenever we can. And I've been in radio a long time, Terry, and I thought that I found my note long ago, but I found up on the roof at the trailer where we broadcast our games at Thomas Run Park, that I found that I hadn't found my voice. It was another spot, a little bit lower in my throat and a little bit lower in my chest, that was much more comfortable for me to work in, and I think much more comfortable for listeners to hear. And I wondered after a while whether it wasn't just a different, whether I'd found the note that had been eluding me all of those years, or whether it was just, you know, working every day on the radio so much, whether I just broke it in properly for the first time.
What's the difference in the sound, do you think?
It's a little bit lower. It's a little bit slower. I think it's a little bit more self-assured, and that you could only succeed at, again, it was like baseball itself, you know, something that's incredibly challenging, but you only succeed when you relax. If you're tense, if you're worried about it, you're not going to be able to do it well. And finally, on the roof of that trailer, I was able to relax into it, and I didn't worry about it. It was an extraordinary feeling of command. I'm not sure that I've ever been in a situation quite like that as a broadcaster before, where toward the end of the year, when I knew all of the stories about all of these players and all of the visiting players as well, and I knew the league as well as anybody knew the league, that I was in command of my material, and it was just the most fun I've ever had.
Why was this season of 2000, the season that you did your play-by-play, why was that the only season that the Aberdeen Arsenal existed?
They were an expansion team. The Atlantic League had started a few years earlier, and they brought in two more teams in this year. And they needed the Aberdeen Arsenal to come in that year because you can't work out the schedule if you just add one team at a time. You get an odd number of teams, and that means one ball club has to be idle every day, and you just can't work the schedule out. So they had to bring two teams in at the same time. The Long Island Ducks were ready to come in. Their ballpark was finished. And the Arsenal had wanted to wait a year and wait till their ballpark was finished before they started. But they needed two teams, so the Arsenal decided to take one for the league, as it were, and come in a year before they were ready and play pretty much on the road the first year. But then they had problems raising the kind of funding that they needed for the ballpark. They had funding arranged through the state and from the county and all kinds of people. But the final piece of this financial puzzle for all of this was to sell skyboxes. And this is as true in minor league baseball as it is true in NBA basketball or Major League Baseball or any sport today. The place that the minor league teams make money is in the luxury boxes. That's a major source of income for them. And these are very expensive. They're normally taken out by local businesses and that sort of thing to entertain clients and as a community commitment. And they couldn't get people to make these commitments for these long-term expensive contracts. There was the people who were marketing this had previously built minor league teams elsewhere in the state of Maryland, so they knew what they were doing. Keith Lupton was the founding general manager of the Frederick Keys and the Bowie Bay Sox. This was a guy who understood his business, and he said he'd never seen such sales resistance. And you would have thought that the magic of the Ripken name, the local hero, that this would have done it, but it didn't. And in fact, people didn't come to the games, and they didn't take out underwriting announcements for the local broadcasts of the games, and they didn't take out ads in the makeshift ballpark, and they didn't buy those luxury boxes. And at the end of the day, that's what killed it.
Neil Conan is the host of NPR's Talk of the Nation and author of the new book, Play by Play. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Vintage Books, publishers of the new paperback Empire Falls by Richard Russo. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on baseball and radio with Neil Conan. Also, Ed Ward remembers Martha and the Vandellas.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Neil Conan, the host of NPR's Talk of the Nation and a longtime reporter and anchor for NPR. 2 summers ago, he took a break from reporting to do play-by-play radio announcing for the minor league baseball team, the Aberdeen Arsenal. It was the team's first season and turned out to also be its last. Conan has written a new book called Play-by-Play, Baseball, Radio, and Life in the Last Chance League. What was it like after your summer of play-by-play to return to your duties at NPR?
Initially, it was difficult. I had, somewhere in the back of my mind, thought that this was going to be a break. Ann Garrels, in fact, had said, you know, something will happen and you won't come back. And it was, to some degree, you know, was it a failure to come back? Had I not done this well enough to make a career out of it, to sidestep and move on? And in that respect, I was a little discouraged. And the other part of it is that I'd hoped to avoid what I'd feared was that joyless presidential election campaign and got back in time to, in fact, anchor the last two presidential debates. And then, as you'll recall, that one went into extra innings and
right.
Got a chance to do quite a bit of that as well, and doing play-by-play of the Florida Supreme Court, not that long after doing play-by-play of the Aberdeen Arsenal. And that part of it was fun, and what I realized was that I had learned while I was away that the thing that I really was interested in, at least now, was in live radio, that I'd really come to love thinking with the last tenth of an inch of your tongue. And that was such a challenge every day, and that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to find a place where I could be on the radio every day, and I honestly wasn't sure that National Public Radio was going to be that place. And so I started looking for other opportunities to do that, and as it happened, the opportunity to do that happened at National Public Radio.
Through Talk of the Nation.
Yeah, exactly.
One thing we didn't mention is, and you talk about this in your book, is that you were kidnapped during the Gulf War.
Mm-hmm.
You were held for a week, and you describe the experience in the book. And you say about it that afterwards you recognized the symptoms of adrenaline addiction, you know, when you were looking back on it and every moment seemed so vivid to you.
Yeah.
And you describe adrenaline addiction as the affliction that drives some reporters from one hot spot to another. Just describe your sense of this adrenaline addiction.
It didn't strike so much in the trip in which I got captured by the Republican Guard and held for a week. As dramatic as that stuff was, and it certainly was vivid, it was almost the next trip back. I went back to Iraq, this time to northern Iraq, with a producer from here, Marie Dilge, and we got a pretty good story. We got a story from various sources that the coalition had missed a lot of Iraq's nuclear weapons program, and this turned out to be, in fact, the entire part of the Iraqi weapons program that nobody had been aware of before the war happened. And that story and the context in which we developed it and all of the excitement and the danger of northern Iraq after the war, it was such a rush. It was so gratifying. It was so exciting. And again, you know, in terms of danger, there are always chances that these stories could be wrong. It didn't turn out that one was. We were right. But, you know, it's tremendously thrilling. And I got this feeling that I used to describe to people, my friends, as feeling big. And I'm not sure exactly what I meant by that, but I guess emotionally big, this feeling that I could fill the room. And this was, at the same time, tremendously, you're aware, you're focused, you're concentrated, but you're also not who you are. You're somebody else. You've transformed into this other character that's driven by things that you're normally not driven by. And those things are difficult to get those two things to work together and to bring yourself back to who you were. And that's one thing that I think having a family was more important in that respect than anything else. There's nothing that will bring you back to earth quicker than children who don't really care about what your pretensions are or how, you know, your emotional inflation is doing that day. What they care about is dad. And that was tremendously important. And I felt like I had to back off after that, that at that moment I had an opportunity, if I'd wanted to take it, to be, you know, that hot shot a foreign correspondent who goes from one hotspot to another, who never gets enough danger, who lives for all of those moments, or I could go back to being who I really was. And to some degree, I decided to go back to who I was, if in no small part for the kids, if nothing else.
You know, but you write about these two emotional extremes that you went through, you know, that kind of addiction to adrenaline thing, the feeling big.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, a feeling of paralysis.
Yeah, that's the
downside. After you came home
of it, yeah.
After the kidnapping. Could you describe that feeling?
Yeah, it's a little bit what I was talking about earlier. It's a little bit, yeah, it's the downside. It's the other side of the rush. It's the crash. And it's the feeling of inability to focus on what you need to do because you're afraid to do it. You become weighed down by expectations to some degree, your own as well as everybody else's, or your projection of what everybody else's expectations of you are. Things become more simple things, like making the first phone call on a story, become very difficult to do. And again, once I got into something, once it happened, once I didn't have time to think about it, I was fine. I was the same person. But thinking about it, getting off the dime, you know, getting myself started became harder and harder to do. And I think that there was this sort of unspecific anxiety. I was afraid. And I'm not sure exactly what I was afraid of. And you think about, you know, being in situations where, you know, they're dangerous and people are shooting. And yes, things can happen, but those don't often happen on the third floor of National Public Radio. And the fact is, there was nothing threatening me there. There was nothing stopping me. I could have been, I could have done a lot more. I'd always had a tendency to passivity. That's always something I'd struggled with and fought to overcome. This just made it worse. And it made my resistance less. And I found, you know, constant excuse making. Things were other people's faults and never mine. And that's what I really felt I had to break out of. There was this spiral that I was getting into. And I come from a family that's had a lot of problems with alcohol. And I was beginning to have problems with alcohol. And that worried me very, very seriously. And I you know, was this it? Was I, you know, spiraling? As to some degree, I'd seen other people in my family spiral, and baseball was my opportunity to say no to that. It just happened to be baseball. It could have been other things, but for me, it was baseball, to step out of that and to take a look at myself and shake myself around a little bit and say, you know, what are you doing? Why are you doing it? And if you don't love it, why do you keep doing it?
You know, the thing about alcohol, being on the road is sometimes the worst thing mm-hmm. for somebody who is drinking a little too much.
You bet. There's a lot of the time there's not much left to do when the ball game ends at, 10:30 and you get back to the hotel at, you know, 11:15, 11:30. And well, you're living the baseball life. You don't want to wake up the next day until noon because that's your schedule you're on. And the only thing that's open is the bar. You know, there's that, or you can go watch cable television up in your room. So, yeah, that can get a little scary, and you can see how those patterns can develop.
But you got through that one.
Did get through that one, yeah. And partly, I'd stopped drinking before I did this, and I did go to the bars, and I would have a few drinks, and sometimes more than a few drinks with, some of the guys and some of the situations. But I felt like I was back in control of it because I felt like I was back in control of my life, that I was doing what I wanted, and it was not a crutch anymore. It was what it had been my whole life, an occasional amusement, something you did sometimes.
My guest is Neil Conan, host of NPR's Talk of the Nation and author of the new book, Play by Play. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Neil Conan, a longtime reporter and anchor for NPR and host of Talk of the Nation. His new book, Play by Play, is about the summer of 2000 when he worked as the play-by-play radio announcer for the minor league baseball team, the Aberdeen Arsenal. We were talking about adrenaline and the kind of rush you can get mm-hmm. from it. Do you think that doing a daily show like Talk of the Nation is very suitable to your temperament now, because you've got the daily deadline, but it's not like a huge thing. It's not like you're getting kidnapped every day,
no,
or you're covering
it's not.
A war every day. But there is this sense of this structure that you constantly have to fit yourself into, and a daily set of deadlines to meet. So there's no time for paralysis.
There isn't. The daily rhythm makes it much easier. You're right about that. It's also that it, like play-by-play, is live, and you never know. I mean, we script. Baseball doesn't have a script, and we try to arrange these programs so that we have an idea of where they're going to be going in this part of the program or that part of the program. But a lot of the time, the program does not work out the way that we had planned it, and that's a great challenge. It's enormous fun. It's a lot. It's doing many of the same kinds of things that I did in play-by-play, at least in terms of technique. And the ability to go back and recap the scoring, a skill that I developed doing play-by-play, has turned out to be very useful in doing live radio. You have to go back and recap the news just about as frequently as you had to recap the scoring, as it turns out. It's live radio. It's the same kind of structure and the same kind of difficulty, the same kind of challenge.
Neil, I've always admired your writing on the air. Now that you've written a book, I'm interested in hearing what it was like for you to sit down and face the fact that you had to write like a couple of hundred pages, not you know, copy for a 6-minute report or copy to introduce a program. It's really daunting.
It is daunting. And the fact is that I had always seen myself as a writer. You know, that when I was in high school, that's what I wanted to grow up to be. And I grew up to be a broadcaster. And the whole idea of, I was intimidated by the idea of writing a whole book. I mean, you know, you and I write in seconds. We don't write in hundreds of pages. And this was a challenge, too. You know, if I was ever going to do it, if I was ever going to achieve that goal that I'd set for myself all those years before, this was going to be the opportunity. And if I didn't do it this time, it was going to be almost impossible. So sitting down and writing this book, one of the big differences between working in a newsroom and writing a book is that one of them is a very social experience where you're yelling at people and they're yelling at you, and there's all kinds of activity going on. Working at home, quiet, staring at a blank computer screen was a very different kind of experience indeed. And one of the most humbling experiences I've ever had was, in fact, you know, you do all the macro editing with your editor at the publishing house, but then eventually you get the book gets sent to a copy editor, and they, you know, they're looking at your spelling and your grammar. I know my spelling's bad. If I could spell, I wouldn't be in radio. But you know, I thought that this was going to be like a Socratic dialogue with an editor. Well, I meant to be in the future pluperfect tense there. Absolutely. Instead, you know, what it came back was just one horrifying literary crime after another. I surrendered, you know, with the third one. I thought I'd been a literate person until I read this.
On radio and in print, length is really important. You can't come in hundreds of pages over for the book that's going to be published. If your report has like 5 minutes on the air, you can't go over that,
right?
Et cetera. Whereas when you're, so everything has to be concise,
mm-hmm.
right? But when you're doing play by play, you have to fill these really long gaps of nothing happening. So, you know, concision isn't what you need. You need like amplification, constant amplification.
What you need actually, Terry, is an accordion. You need to expand it or contract it. Because happen very suddenly. You can start on this, you know, what you're thinking is going to be, an inning-killing anecdote while the while the pitcher continually throws over to first base, and the next thing that happens is a ground ball smack to shortstop, over to second, back to first, double play. We'll see you for the next half inning. So you've got to be able to, you know, adapt all of this stuff, you know, either expand it, and you're right, that's the usual problem, or contract it, and, you know, some of them you have to say, well, we've finished that story in the next inning, but it's incredibly challenging to fill all of that airtime, particularly when you're by yourself. And again, in the minor leagues, for the most part, you're on by yourself. There's no color man, there's no producer, there's no statistician, there's no technique. You're doing all of this stuff yourself, and I would invite anybody who wanted to be on the radio was perfectly welcome to come on and join me for a couple of innings anytime they wanted, just to help me fill all the airtime. But eventually it got to be, you know, this ongoing dialogue between yourself and your audience. And you know, you don't think of your audience in terms of masses of people. And you're broadcasting for the Aberdeen Arsenal. This is a good thing. You think of your audience as individuals. People tend to listen to the radio alone, whether they're, you know, doing the dishes or at work or in their car or, you know, listening to the radio as they're walking or exercising or something like that. So you think of your audience as, you know, it's one to one. And if you're having this ongoing conversation with this one individual, that was the way I came to think about it.
You've been in the position very, very often through your career of having to fill time while waiting for the president to come in and deliver his address, or during the break in the hearings when you had to just keep filling an indefinite amount of time until they decide to end the break. What are some of the differences between the kind of things you need to have at your fingertips and the kind of preparation you need to fill time in the hearings or during the presidential address compared to play-by-play?
Well, one of the differences is normally in National Public Radio, if we're waiting for the president, I have somebody to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
So I can generally say something clever like, Dan? If I'm doing play-by-play, there's nobody there for me to talk to. So I have to come up with something myself. And those sorts of challenges were quite interesting.
Well, Neil Conan, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, it's been a pleasure.
Neil Conan is the host of NPR's Talk of the Nation and the author of the new book, Play-by-Play, Baseball, Radio, and Life in the Last Chance League.
Rosario is at second. Singleton is at first. Called strike one on Espada. Again, not a guy you fear for the long ball, but at this juncture, a single to the outfield could win the game. There's a line drive up the middle. Danny Perez is charging from center field. He picks it up. There's the throw to the plate. It's way offline. Rosario scores, and the ball game is over. Sharp single to center field as Espada does it again to the Aberdeen Arsenal. Gets the RBI hit that ends it. One run for the Bluefish in the bottom of the 13th. There was just one hit, an enormous error, and two men left on base. The error by Matt Taylor proves to be lethal to the cause of the Aberdeen Arsenal. An unearned run does them in, and that is the ball game. We'll be back with all the details on the postgame show, which follows momentarily. On behalf of all of my colleagues at WHFC, especially Rob Chris, who's been very patient, and everybody connected with the Aberdeen Arsenal, thanks very much for listening. I'm Neil Conan. The final score of the game, the Bridgeport Bluefish 4 and the Aberdeen Arsenal 3.
Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward remembers Martha and the Vandellas. This is Fresh Air. Our rock historian Ed Ward says that Motown's history is muddled by aggressively marketed nostalgia, poor reissues, and a general unwillingness to go beyond the big stars and the big hits. Ed says the label's second tier of artists, including Martha and the Vandellas, is worth checking out.
Hey! Oh. Martha Reeves owes her rise in the music business to her unstoppable ambition. Many a young girl would have meekly knuckled under to the Motown brass, but Martha knew she had what it took and fought on. She was born in Alabama. Her father was a preacher, and she and her brothers sang in his church in Detroit, where they'd moved in Martha's infancy. Her school teachers discovered her talent early on, and she sang with high school girlfriends, even scoring some backup work with Chess Records. After graduation, she was working at a dry cleaner's when she won a talent contest that got her a slot at Detroit's famous 20 Grand Club, and there she was spotted by Motown talent scout Mickey Stevenson, who insisted she come visit him at the office, which she did, without an appointment. Stevenson wasn't pleased, but while she was there, an emergency came up, and he told her to watch the phones while he was gone. An hour later, she'd organized things so well that Stevenson hired her as his secretary. Another accident resulted in Marvin Gaye showing up for a session without backup vocalists. So Martha recruited two of her girlfriends and saved the day. In gratitude, Berry Gordy, Motown's head, let them make a record, which he buried on his Mel O.D. subsidiary. Credited to the Vells, You'll Never Cherish a Love So True didn't even feature Martha on lead vocals, but her friend Gloria Williamson instead. Although the record sank without a trace, Gordy offered the girls a contract, but Gloria decided not to join. Martha, Rosalind Ashford, and Annette Beard, though, were all for it, so Gordy said he'd call them the Tillies. When they protested, he asked them to think up something better, and Martha, having seen Della Reese in church the previous week, came up with the Vandellas. After they recorded a couple of duds, they were hooked up with Motown's Holland Dozier Holland hit-making team, and out popped this. Come and Get These Memories did okay, but it wasn't a number one record. And in 1963, Motown was about number one records. So they went back in the studio and made one. Martha and the Vandellas spent the next year trying to recapture that magic, but Motown's attention was elsewhere. After several sound-alikes failed, Holland Dozier Holland were taken off the case, and Mickey Stevenson, Martha's old boss, was put on it. Fortunately, he had a hit in his back pocket. The summer of 1964 was a restless one, and people have claimed that Dancing in the Street was a soundtrack for rioting, but that's preposterous. It celebrated freedom to enjoy yourself, sure, but that was something black and white kids were both doing. That fall, Annette Beard left the group and was replaced by Betty Kelly, another old friend of Martha's. The new blood seemed to invigorate the group. Another hit arrived in the spring of 1966. It's no secret that Berry Gordy played favorites around Motown, and with Diana Ross around, Martha and the Vandellas were not on his A-list. After their next couple of records failed to match Nowhere to Run's popularity, he lost interest in them, and their last number one record came late in 1966. Martha wasn't finished, and she and a changing cast of Vandellas, which latterly came to include her sister Lois, continued to record through 1971, and after that, Martha made several fine records as a solo act. Her music, largely out of print, is worth seeking out, including the Motown non-hits. Maybe someday even Motown will agree with that.
Ed Ward is a writer living in Berlin. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Also by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of With These Hands, a collection of stories by Louis L'Amour, author of May There Be a Road. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Rick Moody, author of The Ice Storm and Demonology. He describes his new book, The Black Veil, as a memoir with digressions. It's about the depression and breakdown he experienced as a young man and their connection to a family legend and a Nathaniel Hawthorne story. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.